of the Ag and Natural Resource Committee, and I'm going to change the agenda a little bit. We have Senator Metzger here who wants to testify on one particular bill, so we're going to open a work session first on that bill. We're going to take the testimony from Senator Metzger and Representative Smith, and then we'll probably close that one and move back to the regular agenda, and then we'll get to that a little later. So I just wanted to let people know kind of what was happening and why the agenda changed, but some people have to get zipping off and do that kind of stuff. So, okay. So, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2465 and Senator Metzger and Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And as you have so noted, your Vice Chair, Representative Patty Smith, from House District 52, here today. I'll just give you a brief overview of the reasons behind HB 2465 for your consideration. And as you move later in the agenda, we have representatives from Hood River School District and the community who will give you more of the details. But House Bill 2465 is designed to address an issue in Hood River, but not unlike issues that I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that you may face in your own communities. And that is the siting of schools, the cost of siting schools. In my interim committee, when I chaired the Senate Committee on Educational Excellence, one of the biggest issues we heard is how do you site schools, how do you pay for new construction, how do you pay for maintenance for our school infrastructure and how important that is. And as a result of that commission, we designed a piece of legislation that will be moving through the process, and Mr. Chair, you and the committee will see hopefully at some point as how the state can provide some assistance in the capital needs of our public school infrastructure. This bill is a reflection of some of those issues. In Hood River, it is extremely difficult to site a school at this stage for a number of reasons, which is why we bring to you HB 2465. It is in the scenic national area. It is limited by the Columbia River on one side, the scenic area within the core of the community. The urban growth boundary, as in every district, is a little different here in that even within the current UGB is high-value farmland. And so you really cannot eliminate the ability to not site on high-value farmland because the Hood River Valley is probably one of the best that you'll find anywhere. This helps to address that particular issue. There will be some questions that will be brought up today, and I'm sure the Department of Land Conservation Development will bring some issues before you, and they are legitimate issues. But I do believe that we need to find a way to work around this as we struggle in this legislature to find the dollars necessary to give our kids the best education possible. And I think it's incumbent on us to try and find ways to do that in a manner that is fiscally wise. Because if it's difficult enough to find the dollars to do that, we don't want to put unnecessary burdens on that cost when we're already struggling to find the programs to make those work. That is the basis for HB 2465. I'll be watching the hearing as you move through that, and again, the specifics will come from the panelists who will give you excellent testimony as to why this is the solution that they and the county and the other advocates have come up with. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll turn it over to Representative Smith.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. I'm Representative Patty Smith, District 52, and Vice Chair of this great committee. Senator Metzger and I sponsored this bill today, and we thank you for the opportunity to tell you a little bit about Hood River County, and I think the Senator explained it very well, and as you'll hear from others that are going to testify today, how difficult siting of the new schools are, but it's truly an important debate that we have in this legislature. Hood River County is 533 square miles, the second smallest county in Oregon. Much of Hood River County is publicly owned, and close to 77% of the county land is unavailable for new schools. So I think that puts it in context what we're facing in Hood River County with siting our new schools, and as you'll hear from the others today, it's very important. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Well, thank you. Any questions of these two?
Thank you
for taking your time. I know how busy it is, so
I
really appreciate you being here, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, sir.
So we will close our hearing on House Bill 2468. Nope, sorry about that. 24, 65. And we're going to have an informational meeting. Now we're going to open an informational meeting on Community Forest Authority. So that is just to get some basic information for some stuff we're going to deal with a little bit later. So we have, who's coming up for that one? Brad? And Representative Burley, do you want to be part of this as well, or do you want to?
No.
Okay.
That's right. Thank you.
And I do want to welcome Representative Burley today to the dais, and I appreciate having you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representatives, my name is Brad Chalfont. I'm the executive director of the Deschutes Basin Land Trust. I'm based in Bend. I'm here to, I guess, give you a report card on a bill that we view as a great success in the last session, and give you hopefully a little more perspective on some of the challenges that we face in the years ahead. Last session, with truly amazing bipartisan support, the Community Forest Authority bill was passed. My organization was involved with that, and we're grateful for the support that we found here in the legislature. Let me tell you just very briefly about my organization, give you a little bit of context, and then we'll tell you where we are with the projects we're trying to put on the ground, and hopefully answer any questions you might have. Again, I'm with the Deschutes Basin Land Trust. We serve the greater Deschutes Basin, the 6.8 million acres. Much of that's public land, but the private lands within there are developing very rapidly, having very big impacts on local communities. We're very concerned with the potential loss of many of the resources and things that have made the Deschutes Basin, Central Oregon, such an attractive place for so many people. My organization has a variety of different programs. We're doing everything from salmon and steelhead reintroduction, open space acquisition in our community preserves program for local communities, and working with private landowners, private farmers, ranchers, timber owners, trying to keep those private productive lands open and productive. That's a very important issue for us in Central Oregon. The Community Forest Authority was of great interest to my organization, among many others, because we've seen nationally a somewhat scary trend. It's been estimated that of the roughly 75 million acres of private commercial timberland in this country, roughly 55 of the million of those acres have changed hands in the last 10 years. And they're not going from one integrated natural resource or timber company to another. They're going to a new breed of owner. Typically, they're called TIMOs, Timberland Investment Management Organizations. What those TIMOs typically do, and I should emphasize, they're largely investor groups. Typically, they have a short investment window. They often look to maximize return, speed up the harvest regimes, and then look at what they have left. Typically, that means breaking timberland up for subdivision development. Once that timber resource is gone, we'll never get it back. That is of great concern to my organization, to the communities I work in, and I think of great concern to many people here in Oregon. We were very concerned in part because in the last few years, a great deal of timberland has essentially come on the market. Crown Pacific limited partners, went bankrupt a number of years ago. Their bankruptcy resulted in passage of their lands to their secured creditors, which then began disassembling those timberlands. Originally, Crown Pacific had roughly 500,000 acres in Oregon and Washington. They immediately moved to sell the lands in Washington State, roughly 200,000 acres. Those lands were disposed of very quickly, and then they began to look at what they could do with the timberlands, roughly 300,000 acres of which are in Central Oregon. Those timberlands are somewhat diverse, and each of the tree farms is somewhat different. And I'd like to talk to you about that because it helps illustrate some of the challenges facing us Community Forest Authority is an incredibly important vehicle, but it's only one tool in the toolbox, and we need your help with some of those additional tools. The tree farm on the southern end of the screen is the Mazama Tree Farm. It's actually in Klamath County, roughly 92,000 acres. The tree farm in the middle, the Gilchrist Tree Farm, is roughly 145,000 acres. And the tree farm due west of Bend is the Bull Springs Tree Farm, or what we've called the Skyline Forest. The Mazama Tree Farm separates Crater Lake National Park from the Klamath National Marsh, a very significant site. It actually isn't of great concern to us at this time because, in fact, there are some deed restrictions on that property that limit the development potential and keep that in sustainable management. The current owners tried to dispose of that property. They set their price a little high, and they didn't get any takers in their first round. But we hope to see that kept in sustainable production in the future. Moving a little further to the north, the Gilchrist Tree Farm is of tremendous interest to us. The roughly 145,000 acres that make up the main block of the Gilchrist Tree Farm has been highly productive for east side forestry forest in the past. It kept alive the communities of Gilchrist and Crescent, and supported one of the last remaining mills in Central Oregon. Absolutely essential to those communities. We're concerned about what the future of those lands will be. We'd like to work with the existing owner, see if we can't find a way to partner with some of the local timber companies or other buyers. One of the ways we may be able to do that is if Forest Legacy is once again available here in the state of Oregon. It would allow us to partner with a private timber company, essentially acquire the development rights, and allow that private timber company to acquire the land for its resource value, essentially its timber value. The reason I make this point is because most of these timberlands, and this isn't exclusive to the Deschutes Basin or Central Oregon, most of these timberlands are being valued for more than their timber. And that makes it very difficult for a private timber company to compete. Frankly, I've had conversations with a number of timber companies, and they're extremely frustrated. It's almost impossible for them to buy land today because they'd be paying far more than what that land would ever generate in terms of a timber revenue. This, if we have Forest Legacy, this would allow us a vehicle to help those timber companies keep those lands in production. And I need to emphasize, we're not about trying to take these off the tax rolls. We're not about trying to take these out of production. We're trying to keep these in the traditional uses that we've seen these lands in, which incidentally includes scenic amenities, wildlife, recreation. The land that we had the highest level of concern with, and frankly the piece of land that was the poster child for the Community Forest Authority Act, was the Bull Springs Tree Farm, roughly 33,000 acres due west of Bend. It's very important for not only the fastest growing part of Oregon, but one of the fastest growing communities in the country. This aspect helps you understand why it's so important. It's the scenic view that's selling an awful lot of very expensive real estate. It's driving the growth in Central Oregon. It's bringing tourism in. It's important for the quality of life, much less the timber resource that it's traditionally produced. It's visible from throughout Central Oregon. This timberland is surrounded on most sides by national forest. If this land were developed, the implications for the remaining national forest would be interesting, to say the least. It's likely the national forest would begin looking at getting out of those lands. Likely it would be impossible for them to manage wildfire issues the way that they would like to manage them. Once you start putting houses in the forest, you have to start putting lives on the line to try and defend those houses. Our vision is to try and protect not only the scenic views, but recreation for a very rapidly growing community, educational opportunities, critical wildlife habitat, and maintain timber jobs. These lands are not pristine old-growth forests. These are commercial timberlands. You can see that they've been harvested pretty heavily. But those lands can be productive for a long, long time to come. They can also, in the process, provide recreation, habitat, as I mentioned, an outdoor classroom for local schools, and a model for sustainable forestry. My organization is doing active forestry on the lands we manage. We took off roughly 1 million board feet about a year ago. Those are lands that were primarily being managed for wildlife habitat, but it gives us an opportunity to explain to a somewhat skeptical public that it's important to manage these lands. You can't just lock them away. It allows us to cross a lot of barriers. And frankly, I think it was one of the reasons that we had great success in the last session. We were able, with a number of different partners, to bring together groups, individuals who wouldn't normally work together, and it allowed everyone to work across party lines. This is where we hope to go in the future. Crown Pacific, as I said, filed bankruptcy roughly 5 years ago. House Bill 2729, the Community Forest Authority Act, was passed in the last session. I was hoping that by now I would bring you a success story that we'd acquired these timberlands, but as is often the case with real estate transactions, they have a life of their own. We only work with willing sellers, and so we have to work on their timeline. The Land Trust announced shortly after you passed HB 2729 that we intended to try and acquire the Skyline Forest. Deschutes County shortly thereafter authorized and created the first community forest authority in the country. Ownership of these timberlands then shifted. The holding company, the creditors that had acquired the timberlands, the ownership of that holding company changed. A large corporate entity acquired the controlling interest. At that time, canceled an auction that we were preparing for and told us that they wanted to work with us. And at this time, we're engaged in negotiations, discussions, trying to work out a deal that works both for that landowner as well as for the communities of Central Oregon. Now, this report that I'm trying to present is, I'm fairly confident, going to result in a very positive, satisfactory result for Central Oregon. But I should point out, this is a real issue throughout the state of Oregon. I happen to sit on the State Parks Commission. We were approached recently by folks out in the LeGrand area who were quite concerned about timberland overlooking LeGrand, the recreational use, the timber production that has come off those lands, the wildlife use, of great concern to the local community. Unfortunately, there is no land trust out there to assist the folks in the LeGrand. We would hope that in the future, perhaps the Oregon Department of Forestry might be able to assist communities, rural communities, that don't have a private nonprofit to be able to assist them. If ODF is allowed to do acquisitions, and I need to emphasize, not compete with private timber concerns, but assist where necessary, it's going to be a resource that I think would be sorely or greatly appreciated in those rural communities. Essentially, you'd be throwing those communities a lifeline. So that's where we stand with our project today. I certainly hope that before the next session, we'll be able to tell you we've acquired the forest and we're putting timber workers back to work. But for now, it's still a work in progress. And again, thank you for your assistance and your support in the last session. And I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Boquist.
Yeah, thank you. Could you clarify, you said to authorize the CFA. Is it your organization that's the CFA, or what is the structure of the CFA?
Well, the way the CFA works, it's a quasi-governmental entity that essentially a county sets up. The legislature's judgment last session was that it was not appropriate for counties to acquire these lands. You wanted an independent nonprofit to keep these lands in private ownership and on the tax rolls. So our organization is partnering with the Community Forest Authority. The Community Forest Authority is somewhat akin to the community hospital authorities that are in existence in many communities around Oregon, where the entity essentially finances acquisitions of hospitals.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yeah.
That's not my question, because I was here last session and very familiar with the CFA. My specific question is the county authorized or you authorized to form a CFA over there? So is there an existing CFA that has been formed, and what is that structure? What's its name? What's the status of that? Thank you.
My apologies. Yes, they did authorize a community forest authority. It's called the Deschutes County Community Forest Authority. They've retained bond counsel. My organization raised the funds to do the initial work with the county so that there was no cost to the county in setting that up. In essence, they're on hold until we have a transaction to bring to them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Burley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad, thanks for coming over today. And pretty exciting, I think. We got a bill passed in less than 2 years. It's already, actually, probably less than a year was being implemented. Just real quickly, we're going to be having a public hearing following this on House Bill 2468, Forest Legacy Bill. How would that type of authority help you in an effort such as this?
Thank you. The one of the issues that we have, community forest authority can essentially fund the timber value of a property. But as I said, most, if not all, of these properties will be going for a value far higher than that. The Forest Legacy Program is essentially designed to acquire the development rights from commercial timberland. If we had that as a vehicle, that could be a very useful means of buying down the cost of timberland. It could be used on projects like the Gilchrist Tree Farm and working with a private timber company, wherein the private timber company, as I said, would acquire the land. We would acquire the development rights from them via the Forest Legacy Program. In the case of Skyline Forest, that's a forest that's adjacent to a very rapidly growing community. It's not likely that you're going to see a private timber company come in and can acquire those sorts of lands. The community has a real interest in owning those lands. They have a high recreational value. In that case, it probably makes more sense for an organization like mine to acquire that land using, again, Forest Legacy to buy down development rights, using the Community Forest Authority to buy the timber value. Undoubtedly, we will have to raise additional money for the project that we're looking at Skyline Forest. The values, as is the case throughout Central Oregon, are through the roof. But we're in a position to conduct a capital campaign, private capital campaign, to raise private funds to supplement what would be available from Forest Legacy as well as from the Community Forest Authority.
Thank you.
Representative Ving Pelper.
Thank you. And thank you, Brad, for being here. I appreciate it. And we are going to be, as you know, as you just heard, hearing the bill on the Forest Legacy, and that's been an issue I've been working on for three sessions, so I'm really pleased to see this bill in front of us. But on another issue, Measure 37, are you seeing impacts on property values that you're going to have to be dealing with? In other words, there's more competition, there's waivers. I don't know if, you know, the properties you're looking at would be eligible, but how is that going to impact your ability to purchase land in the future for development rights?
Measure 37 does not come into play with respect to these timberlands that I'm describing today. However, Measure 37 obviously does have a very real impact within our basin. There are a number of properties that are now likely to see some level of development. Whether it's going to affect values is a little hard to say. Frankly, it really depends on what the legislature decides to do this session. There is obviously, as you know, a great deal of uncertainty with surrounding Measure 37. So I'd be speculating as to how that plays out in terms of values. If those lands do become developable, in fact, it will certainly increase the cost of acquiring some of those lands. Conversely, it may actually flood the market and diminish the value of other lands. The impacts of Measure 37 are obviously going to be very difficult to predict ahead of time.
Thank you.
Thank you. My question, I think last session when we were talking about this particular forest, one of the issues that came up was the indigenous elk herds that are there and use that corridor moving back and forth. And since we're hearing buffalo later, elk have a tendency to be similar when they're going from one place to the other, in housing and those kinds of stuff. So it becomes part of that whole issue when you manage this as a forest. You maintain those corridors for elk and other things that then don't send them to other places where you have development. Is that something you see?
Absolutely. The forest just outside of Bend, the Skyline Forest or Bull Springs, has been identified as critical big game habitat. The biologists at ODFW tell me that if we were to lose that property to development, it's quite likely they would not be capable of managing that herd, the Tumalo elk and deer herd, as a unit. That doesn't, of course, mean that we won't have deer and elk in the area. Living in downtown Bend, I occasionally have deer wander past my home. However, the ability to manage these herds as units provide great resources in terms of hunting, wildlife viewing, etc. I spent some time with the Oregon Hunters Association last summer at their convention. They've been strongly behind this bill, strongly behind this effort. And again, it's remarkable to bring so many disparate entities and groups together on something, but it looks like we've got that kind of a winner in these kinds of projects. We need to have development in the state, but there are places that that we need to protect for the resources that have made this such a wonderful state.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, and we will close our informational hearing on the Community Forest Authority, and I appreciate that information. It'll be helpful later when we start talking about some of the other issues today, including the legacy bill. But now we'll go back, and we will open a public hearing on 2465. Here we go. So let's start with, Pat Everson?
Evenson Brady.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Superintendent.
She's a superintendent.
And is there anyone else that you would like to have come up with or with you?
Yes, would be all right if the two board members.
Absolutely.
That way you can listen to us all three at once and ask us questions all at once.
And Mr. Chair, did you get the handouts that Senator Metzger
gave? Yes, they should be in front of everybody.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Amazingly low tech.
Thank you very much for listening to us today. I'm Pat Evenson Brady, and I'm the Superintendent of Schools for Hood River County School District, and I live in Hood River County. Imagine most of you have visited Hood River County. Maybe you came up in the spring to look at the blossoms when they're really beautiful. That'll be coming soon. Maybe you came up in the fall to look at the fruit trees, to buy fruit, to taste some of our local wine. Or maybe you've been around to do some of our recreational activities year-round. And that's the tourist view of Hood River County. And we live in a wonderful place, and we're delighted to live there. The flip side of that tourist economy is a county in desperate need of some space to build schools. Our county is, as Patty Smith noted, 533 square miles, the second smallest county in the state, a little over 21,000 residents. Of those residents, about 4,000 are students. When you think about Hood River, I suspect you think about condos and a very nice place to vacation, but 50% of our students qualify for free or reduced price meals. All of our schools qualify as high poverty schools in Hood River. We have a significant number of people whose income is not commensurate with some of the lovely homes that have been built in our area. 30% of our kids are English language learners. So that's a little different look at Hood River County schools than maybe the tourist view that we enjoy as well as you. The chart on the bottom shows you the enrollment increases in Hood River County schools over the last 10 years. We're a slowly growing district. We grow at about 1% a year. That's about 40 kids a year at our population base. So that's close to two classrooms of kids every year. The last time we built new schools in Hood River County, we've added on classrooms regularly, but the last time we built new schools in Hood River County was in 1970. So we certainly don't look like a Beaverton with galloping growth, but we certainly do have a problem in that we need to regularly build more schools and more classrooms in our community. So we are a small county, and I want to show you just how small.
This is Hood River County. Just to orient you, this is the river on the north. This little bump is the summit of Mount Hood, 11,245 feet. Hood River, as you know, provides a good deal of the search and rescue activity on Mount Hood because it's actually in our county. My standard joke for the new teachers is I'm really, really glad that nobody...
My standard joke for the new teachers is that I'm really, really glad that nobody lives at the top of Mount Hood and that we don't have to transport them to school. And that is true, too. We actually are a county unit school district, so our farthest west school is Cascade Locks. That's a K-12 school over on this side. The town of Hood River is represented in white. That's the urban growth boundary. We have two schools inside the urban growth boundary. We have three schools inside the urban growth boundary. And then a couple of other schools that I'll be mentioning. This is Pine Grove School out here inside the three-mile growth buffer. We have a middle school and an elementary school at Odell. And then finally down here at Parkdale is our furthest south school. So nine schools. You probably noticed the colors on the map. And so you'll probably recognize that the darkest green is federal forest land, comprising 61% of the land mass of Hood River County. The lighter green land is county forest land, about 9%. 70% of the land in Hood River County is federal or county forest land. In addition, 7% of the land is high-value exclusive farm use land. And then, so we can't site schools on that 77% of our land. The last big barrier for us is the three-mile growth buffer around the urban growth boundary, and that's the red area. That's about 20% of the remaining land after you subtract out the forest land. So you begin to see the issue for us about siting schools. Hood River is unique because we're so small. So much of our land is high-value exclusive farm use land and or forestry land. We've been looking for land to build a school now for about 3.5 years. We've hired land use consultants to work with us. The issue is partly availability and partly cost.
By the way, two of these schools are actually constructed on high-value exclusive farm use land, Pine Grove and Y.E. School, already built there. I guess, as we were chatting earlier,
we probably have our own Measure 37 claim on one of them, because when we bought it in 1970, we could have built a school on it.
Mr. Chair, public bodies aren't allowed to.
Really, Corbett School filed one.
Sort of grass pass.
Just kind of was thinking about it.
Yeah.
It was interesting. Maybe he can help.
There you go.
There you go.
So we've been looking and looking for land to build schools. And as you know, schools are a permitted use on not high-value EFU. And so some of our schools are on that. Two of them are actually on high-value. We're told that LCDC will not consider cost in granting a goal exception. And that makes some sense to me, even to me. But the issue for us is that Oregon provides no significant level of state support for construction of schools. 97% typically of the cost of school construction is borne by the 21,000 residents of Hood River County, many of whom are not particularly affluent folk. Construction costs have risen 30% in the last 30 months. The school that we could have built for $10 million in 2005 now is going to cost us closer to 13, and as far as we know, those construction costs will still rise. So cost is a serious issue for our voters because we have to sell them on a construction bond levy. I looked on one of our local realtors' webpage over the weekend just to, you know, find out kind of what was happening. Land inside the urban growth boundary in small parcels, like a tenth of an acre, up to $1 million an acre, 10 parcels, $1 million an acre. Land outside the UGB, $18,000 an acre to $132,000 an acre. This, I just pulled this off of one web page. Inside the urban growth boundary, 10 out of 11 parcels were over $900,000 an acre. And those were, again, small little lots, not any significant acreage. High-value EFU currently looks to me to be, again, just from the web page, running between $18,000 and $70,000 an acre. So you see the argument that our voters will make to us, whether or not it makes sense to LCDC, is there's land that would be cheaper, and you have to pass this cost on to us. So what are the options for us? One is to say to you, you know what? These very well-intentioned land use rules don't work very well in a county as small as Hood River with the kind of restrictions on our land. I guess we could try buying some very expensive land and seeing if our voters would support us on that. Not very confident about that. Or we can try to find some not high-value farmland outside the urban growth boundary and bus our kids from down closer to the locus of the growth, bus them 7 to 10 miles up valley. We'd prefer to have neighborhood schools. So I guess what I'd say to you is I kind of feels like Lake Wobegon. I'm sure every school district is unique in some way. Hood River County has its own unique features, which we've tried to share with you. But we do live in a small community where a huge percentage of the land is not available for siting schools, and land costs will be an issue in our ability to sell bonded indebtedness to our voters. We need legislative relief from these well-intentioned land use rules that don't work well. It seems to us that schools are different from other kinds of land use. They play a unique role in a community. The facilities and the fields that we provide benefit the entire community, not just the K-12 kids, and that's worth considering in looking at modifying land use rules just for schools, just in Hood River County, is what we're asking. So, Mike, do you want to?
Yes, I'm Mike Oates. I'm the chairman of the county, Hood River County School Board. Just so happens that I was also on the County Planning Commission during the development of the comprehensive plan and the zoning and the urban growth boundary, as well as being the chairman for 2 years during the development of the urban growth boundary. When we set up that urban growth boundary 30-some years ago, one of the things we were asked to do and required to do was make sure we included lots of land that were large enough for placements of things such as schools. So when we developed that urban growth boundary, we included several orchards. Today, those orchards are all gone with the exception of one fairly large orchard still within the urban growth boundary, and that's it. When we go talk to that individual about wanting to purchase, he says, go away, you can't afford me. And so, in a lot of ways, the development of the comprehensive plan and the urban growth boundary worked real well for locating of development and housing and efficiencies. One way it hasn't worked real well is the siting of schools, and that's why we're here today. We have a problem. We've been trying, as Pat said, for 3.5 years to find a parcel that we could justify. We can't. We're having a hard time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking your time to listen to us today. I wanted to impress upon you how vigilant the Hood River County School Board
has
been.
Need to have your name, too.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Jeff Kopecky, and I'm one of the members of the school board. I want to impress upon you how vigilant this search has been over the last 3 years to site a school, and how hard members of the school board have worked. We've gone through different elections. Members have come and gone through the school board. They have been exceptionally vigilant about passing information along as to how to help site the schools, the difficulties that we face, especially with the minuscule amount of land that's available to us. It's been a multi-year process. We've done our homework. We've looked at Bend. We've looked at Barlow. We've looked at other school districts of similar size in numbers. And not just the administrators, all of us folks who are elected officials that get paid the big bucks for being on the school board. And we've just found how difficult it is to deal with this with the lack of available land. We look at all kinds of things, like energy costs. What's it going to cost us to bus kids south? What will that cost us in the future in oil dependency on other countries? How are we going to deal with neighborhood schools if we can't do that? How do we teach kids to walk to school and be healthy if they're getting on the bus every morning? And all types of other issues that enter into this, just because we're hamstrung by the lack of availability of land. Please help us do what's right for the future of Oregon and the students in Hood River County. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we'd be pleased to answer questions if
there
were some.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What type of school are, I'd read in one of these articles, I think about a 25-plus acre parcel within 3 to 4 blocks of Westside. What type of school are you looking at building in this particular case?
Our current need is an elementary school. However, if we need an elementary school today, even we can figure out we need a middle school tomorrow, and then we're going to have to figure out when you make two high schools a really tough decision sometime within the next 10 years. We did an enrollment study in 05, and that 1% growth rate is expected to continue or perhaps accelerate, depending on some issues within the county, such as a casino in Cascade Locks or other economic development possibilities. So we're confident that we need more than one school just for the kids who are in school now. We would like a large enough parcel to be able to co-locate schools because that reduces operating costs and reduces infrastructure needs. So we're really looking at how can we build efficient schools to serve the needs of the students.
Got two more, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I think this, I don't remember who said it. I'm sorry. I'll just ask all three of you and you figure out who should answer. Is this essentially, besides the one orchard where I think it was Mike said that, you know, essentially it's too expensive, the one guy is inside the UGB has got orchard land, is there other properties from a physical size standpoint that would work? So essentially my question, is it really just cost or is it also, you know, parcels that are big enough? I know it's, you know, physically tight as well.
That's the one parcel that's large enough. There is another parcel, probably half the size we're looking at. I mean, you could do some things differently. As far as the cost thing, I realize in land use planning, you're not supposed to necessarily take into consideration the cost, but being involved with this process for some 30 years, I think you get to a point where, you know, some things just aren't realistic. We had to go out and tear houses down and clear them off so we'd put a school. I mean, it's not very realistic.
So just to follow up on that point, so there's the orchard parcel that the owner said it's not even worth talking about, and then there's one other parcel, but it's really expensive. And then beyond that, there's really no other physical parcels, regardless of cost, just there are no physical spaces big enough, as far as you know? Or
not for sale.
Not for sale.
Right, so then you're talking condemnation or figure out how to get them to sell it in other ways.
And the orchard, by the way, that is within the urban growth boundary is zoned for standard residential density. So that's saleable at $1 million an acre, as far as I can tell, just from looking on website.
One more, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
So talk to me for a second about the... I mean, the reason the exclusive farm use part or high-value farmland is the presumption is going to be farming on it. So talk to me about the neighboring farms. Are there neighboring farms? What about spray? You know, kids and schools next to orchards are a real issue, and that's kind of why we do a lot of this. So what's the positioning of this property in location to other working orchards? Or, you know...
And we're not looking, by the way, at a specific piece of property at this moment. We have an option on one piece of property.
I'm sorry, I thought I read something.
Yeah,
like that.
And we do have an option on a piece of property, but we couldn't add on to some other schools unless we had this. It's not just a piece of property that we're interested in. We're going to face the same problem down the road in several other schools. We are surrounded by orchards in all of our schools except two. And we manage to work with the growers. They work very carefully with us. I was speaking earlier with a grower who says, yeah, now I get up at 2:30 in the morning to put my spray on. So I recognize the restrictions that this places on our growers, but gosh, they've been, in my own personal experience and professional experience, very cooperative with us. I understand that the other reason that the high-value farmland and not, the urban growth boundary, the three-mile buffer, was created was to avoid urban sprawl. And because so much of the land is high-value farmland, that's not really an issue. You're not going to be able to sprawl onto it with residences because it is, in fact, high-value farmland.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. You're looking at the owner of the Parkdale Orchard right outside of the fence there. That's ours. It's not quite as easy as getting up at 2:30 in the morning. We live in fear of how to deal with spray during school times. So it is a challenge. I can tell you that. I did want to ask about, I just read an article about a specific parcel, I guess. So in general, this is sort of an ongoing problem, not just, you know, one school, not just one parcel. This is a larger issue. I think I've got that part right. But this one that you have the option on, you know, or this, essentially there's an article here that talks about a 25 plus acre parcel within 3 to 4 blocks of Westside. And I know the area, so I'm kind of picturing what we're talking about. Does that particular one have orchard around it or not? Because I can't recall if it's houses already or if it's basically orchard stuck among, you know, other orchards.
Well, it's an area where it's kind of been split up between orchards and non-orchards. Mm-hmm. It does have a small orchard on its north side and an orchard on its west side. Mm-hmm. And it is an existing orchard at this time.
That's got it. Thank you very much. That's all I got.
Thank you. Question?
I guess this is best directed to Mr. Oates, but somebody else can jump in. Have you explored an expansion of the urban growth boundary if there are not suitable sizes of parcels of land available inside the boundary? That would suggest that the urban growth boundary needs to move out. So rather than moving a full 3 miles out for sort of what is clearly primarily ag land, what about at the edge, moving the boundary out so that if you have a parcel, then it's of suitable size and character to build a school?
Sure. Yes, we certainly have explored that, and that is certainly a possibility. And we might be able to expand it just for a school. The price of the land directly adjacent to the urban growth boundary is, again, significantly expensive. Just expanding the urban growth boundary in general, not specifically for a school, is generally, we've been advised by the land use consultant, is blocked by the existence of parcels inside the urban growth boundary that are not for sale. So in other words, there is a stock of housing, 20-year stock of housing land inside the UGB. It's just not for sale.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mokwitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may not know the answer to this, but can you tell me, how did Measure 30, did Hood River County vote on Measure 37? Up or down?
Yeah. Up. just barely, I think.
Just a question, follow up, and I think this may be for Beth, because I'm kind of not pro or con, Mr. Chair, but I'm kind of looking at this. I mean, when you expand, without expanding the urban growth boundary, and then we're going to look at going out 3 miles, and then we're going to have city services, and some city or somebody's going to pay for city services to punch it out 3 miles, and then establish a school on a 25-acre parcel, it seems to me like we're expanding the urban growth boundary in one way or the other, because in tropical rainforests, you know, when you build the road, they come. So therefore, deforestation happens, and I think it's kind of the same exact situation here, and I'm kind of just wondering how we address that. And likewise, as a representative to my right mentioned, this isn't the only school district we have this problem. This isn't common. This is a one-time fix here, it kind of looks like. And if there is a problem, maybe we address the problem. But I guess I have more questions than I have answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know I said I was done. Just one more. Representative Boquist triggered something. The city wrote in a letter to us that they would support a change and they would support extending city infrastructure to support the building. So I guess my question is, once they lay all that infrastructure, is it really cheaper? You know, I mean, the city property taxpayers are going to pay or tax credit back to somebody to build all that infrastructure out. If they'd support this, wouldn't they support helping you buy it and just give you the money and you buy the one inside the, you know, the UGB?
We haven't explored that.
Okay. And I'm sympathetic to your issue. I really am.
Yeah. And I should say, not only the city of Hood River, but also the city of Cascade Locks, that doesn't really gain anything by this, the port of Cascade Locks, the port of Hood River, and the Hood River Chamber of Commerce all support this bill. They all recognize, the importance of schools in the community to the economic life of the community, the social life of the community, and all of them support this bill.
Okay. Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and like Representative Clem, and before I speak too far, and Representative Smith throw something at me. I'm supportive of this, but there's 198 of school districts that have the same problem.
One at a time.
Representative Smith, I didn't say no. But I think it's, you know, it begs to differ that there are other school districts out there in search of the same problem, and some of them, you know, have expanded. Bend is one example where they don't have any place to expand, and maybe a slightly more, without opening a can of worms, a slightly more expansive response that's yet containable. From my personal perspective, that Measure 37 passed means the voters there are looking for options. So.
Okay. Representative?
Mr. Chair, though not being a member of the committee, but I just wanted to share with the committee that, you know, Representative Hunt and I had been co-chairing a work group during the interim to kind of look at some options and some things addressing specifically the brick-and-mortar question, the capital for K-12. You know, how can we help with the issue of trying to get schools? And this issue came up very clearly, and I simply offer for the committee's consideration that there's another bill I think that addresses this question in a more general scope that we may want to take a look at that and see how this would dovetail with that effort as well.
Okay.
I don't know the number, no.
I just wanted to comment on that. I want to thank the people from Hood River for coming today, and I think this is a worthy debate. This is the debate that we are facing, not only in Hood River County but around the state. So I appreciate all the comments, and I think we just need to find a solution.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. We have a few more people to testify.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is it open? No. Fritz von Lopkin, also from Hood River.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'm Fritz von Lopkin, 1125 Indian Creek Road, Hood River, and I farm approximately a half mile from the orchard site that we were talking about. And this, I did send you all a letter by email because I didn't think I was going to be able to get here to testify. So pretty much what I wanted to address is in that letter, and my concern was more with the one site which presently has Orchard on it outside the urban growth boundary. I do not have a problem, in fact I sympathize with their problem very much, with if we're looking at properties within or adjacent to the urban growth boundary, which makes sense, but we seem to be picking on the high-value farmland once again. And one thing I was trying to keep my letter to one page, I did not get a paragraph in there, which I did want to discuss the extension of infrastructure and services, which cost all of us considerably, plus it puts pressure on other properties within that area. Because the orchard property in question does have two operating orchards on two sides of it, and that is high-value farmland from there on out. So you do have the problem of additional pressures because of that. The other concern I have that I did mention in the letter is I understand that we're asking, or the school district is asking for more or less one time only for us bill here, but from past experience on land use and so forth, I can tell you that you're going to have a lot of people come before you with the same request using that as a precedent, and also the courts will have this presented to them with this as a precedent. And to do it, I think it would be a very difficult situation to do it for one specific issue or property or entity. So the other thing that is concerned to me, we're talking about cost, and the orchard property is $70,000 an acre, and there's, you can only imagine what that is going to do to the imagination of some other orchardists pretty soon. Measure 37 has already done that, in fact, that approximately one quarter of our orchard land has filed Measure 37 claims in the county, which is a considerable amount, and everybody is throwing around these high dollar figures that Pat was talking about, which are quite unrealistic, but that's what everybody thinks their property is worth. So it does create a difficult situation. If you have any questions for me, I'll be happy to answer them. My main issue was with the actual orchard property, however.
Okay. Any questions of this person? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Mike McCarthy, Parkdale, Oregon.
I'm Mike McCarthy. I farm in Parkdale, mostly raise pears. I've been involved in land use planning in Hood River County for 27 years now. It's kind of a real interest of mine. Been very interested in protecting farm and forest land in Hood River County, and presently involved in the Mount Hood Wilderness Bill. If any of you have read about that, we're trying to get that through the National Congress. This is a really difficult discussion for me to have because I don't like to oppose what's being done by our school district. We have a very dedicated staff of individuals at the Hood River County Schools, especially Dr. Evenson Brady. I'm a supporter of education and have been a long time, and all my kids went through the Hood River school system. I do oppose this bill. Also, my wife was on the school board for 18 years and dealt with some of these issues, and one of the issues that she did deal with was she got a number of calls from people about the Parkdale schools and their kids getting sprayed. So to say this isn't an issue, it's a very serious issue, and she dealt with it a lot, and I can remember a lot of long, hot phone calls about that. So, but as far as I'm concerned, this bill has several problems. One of them is I don't like to see laws applied to even one area, even if it's my area. I don't think that's the way we should legislate, and I think Representative Smith is right that in the long term we need to seek a better solution that works for everybody, probably. Also, I'm a strong advocate of protecting farmland, and I don't think that farmland should always be your default. For whatever it is, wherever you want to put it, it always goes to farmland. That's what we always do in this country, and I don't believe in it, and I would hope that the schools would be one of the primary leaders in leading us to not take that alternative. And the third one is, I really don't think this is the right fix. I think the right fix is SDC charges for schools. And for some reason, this state, in their infinite wisdom, has decided that we don't get to have SDC charges for schools. And that's a state law, I believe, in this state, that we cannot have them. And I think in the long run, this is really the answer. And as a part of my interest in land use for the last 27 years, I've had this conversation with previous superintendents before Dr. Evenson Brady, and suggested to them that we live in a growing community. We need to figure out a way how we're going to fund new schools in the next 20 years or so. And I said, we need to go to the legislature, and we need to propose that we can have SDCs for schools. And I did that with Dr. Boogie, who was before Dr. Evenson Brady. I also discussed it with Dr. Pratton. Some 20 years ago, we had that discussion about we have to have a way to fund schools, and it's got to be through SDC charges. And as you all know, growth is expensive. Most people don't know how expensive growth is because we don't sit down and do the calculations. But there's been studies done in Oregon that claim that for each residence we put on the ground, there are $50,000 worth of system development charges that should be applied to that residence. And right now, we're not, in most cases, there's none that are applied to a residence. Sometimes some very small charges by the planning department. At least that's the way it is in Hood River County. So I think that the ultimate fix is to have sufficient SDC charges so that schools can afford to put these places, these new schools, where they belong. And where they belong is not where the land is cheapest. Where they belong is where the growth is and where the growth will be occurring. And that's really what the focus needs to be. And I would hope that the legislature would look at a package to develop SDCs in the long run and not sidestep this issue anymore. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Peggy Lynch.
Good afternoon, Mr. Yes. Chair and members of the committee. I'm representing the League of Women. My name is Peggy Lynch. I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We are a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government in order to build better communities statewide. The League has long been a supporter of Oregon's statewide land use planning program and the 19 goals. I officially have to read that every time. The League continues to believe that in a statewide land use planning program, so we do not support legislation that treats one applicant in a local decision in a special way. Passing a special law for one special circumstance subverts the statewide program. There is a valid exceptions process, and Representative McPherson discussed that issue. But you heard Senator Metzger, you've heard many of your own members talk about the fact that we need a statewide solution for getting schools and land use planning together. And the League is very interested in supporting legislation that will recognize the fact that schools are a member of this community. A separate consideration in this case is whether it makes good sense to locate a school outside the boundary where most of the students reside. We know that we want elementary students to walk or bike to school whenever possible, and we want to have those schools close to parents to encourage volunteerism. We know that high schools, if they're located outside of the area, and frankly, I live in the Corvallis area, and although we have a high school inside the UGB, it's outside the city limits. One of the two is outside the city limits. And let me tell you about the traffic situation on that local road. Many schools are used for community purposes, health clinics, community centers, public hearings, and so on. So those are good planning reasons why locations of new schools should be integrated into our communities. So we ask that you reject this bill and instead work with schools to assure there is available land and money for capital, for school facilities and inside urban growth boundaries. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Is it Bob Rudy and Jim Johnson? ODA and DLCD.
Chair, Madam Co-Chair, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I'm here to try and in some regard at least give you some idea about what Oregon land use law does say about school siting and why some of those policies exist. And I want to start off making sure you understand. We understand how difficult this problem is. We've seen this session after session, and we have in past sessions responded with changes to state law and with changes to Oregon's land use goals and rules. And it may be that we haven't, obviously we're still not there, and we may need to continue working on those solutions. We're also very sympathetic to the issues that Hood River faces, and we heard, I think, a very good presentation about those. Right now, what I've handed out to you is a recent issue from the Oregon School Boards Association, where they discussed getting schools back into the heart of neighborhoods. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the land use planning principles of urban growth boundaries and of community growth. And then Mr. Johnson will talk to you about the farmland issues, which are also at the heart of our concerns with this bill. Communities began moving away from neighborhood-centered schools in the 70s, especially because of land prices, but also for ball fields and other reasons why schools began getting larger and larger. Today, the footprint of a school parking lot is generally bigger than the school itself, and where once we fit elementary schools into a block, we now have 10 or 15-acre schools and even larger, where once high schools were on 3 or 4 acres, they're now as much as 80 acres. Schools on large sites in outlying areas do have hidden costs, and a lot of those have to do with transportation. Right now in Oregon, we spend about $325 per student to bus students. We have the state pays when students are bused more than a mile. Roughly half of Oregon students are bused, and that compares to, for example, 16% in California. What this issue describes is a number of case studies and examples of communities that have made real and successful efforts to try to keep schools sited within the community that they serve, where students can walk or bike to school. I think the first thing that we have tried to do in regards to this is to make sure that Oregon's land use planning goals with regard to urban growth boundaries actually require that cities and counties in planning for urban growth make sure that they also include schools. It's one thing to have rules like that. I think it's another thing for them to be realized, there's a lot of blame to go around from all parties on that. But in general, what we've seen over the years is that cities, counties, and school districts have not worked very closely together in the process of planning urban growth boundaries and in the process of expanding urban growth boundaries. Two sessions ago, we worked closely in helping to pass legislation for high growth school districts. That's now in 195. I think Ms. Petrino may have passed out that to you. That's to assure that school districts, cities, and counties work together on a 5-year facilities plan, and then make sure that the urban growth boundary provides land for those schools. But LCDC went further than that, and 2 years ago amended statewide Goal 14 so that rather than plan a 20-year land supply in urban growth boundaries just for housing and just for all the employment, commercial, and industrial needs, that goal is now crystal clear that the 20-year land supply in urban growth boundaries is supposed to include schools. And I think that is, in the long run, that's the best solution we can think of, and I think it's a solution in this case. If the city of Hood River indeed does not have even enough land for housing, or if there is enough land for housing but isn't for schools, it's pretty clear to us that urban growth boundary needs some adjustment to provide long-term for schools. Whether that means this particular site or other sites that are in proximity, maybe closer proximity to the neighborhood that this school is going to serve, I don't know those answers, but I am also here today to commit the resources of our department to working with the city and county and the district in trying to solve this. A year ago, the City of Ontario and our staff got together. We provided what we call one of our quick response grants, and we did spend quite a bit of department resources in working with that city and trying to plan long-term for school siting, and that was in response to an initial request similar to what you see today on the part of the City of Ontario to try to find a site that was quite separated from the community that the school was going to serve. I would like to have the opportunity, our department would like to have the opportunity to at least explore the option that we explored there. That may be more exploration of existing sites, and it probably would involve exploration of opportunities for expanding the urban growth boundary. I can't tell you today whether that will mean this particular site, but I think that's a good way to go in the long run. We do have concerns about not only this bill, which is a bill for just one particular situation, but what we also understand will probably be legislation you'll see later to eliminate LCDC's rules that do prevent the siting of schools outside urban growth boundaries. The more successful the state has been in protecting farmland, unfortunately, the more successful we have been in keeping the price of that farmland low, and that's part of the picture. And no doubt those two things are in collision, because we also understand that school districts need to find sites they can afford. But I don't think this legislation is the way to do that. I do think the amended urban growth boundary rules that we've adopted and some work with the city will yield a solution in this case and in other cases. And for that reason, we don't support this particular bill.
Thank you.
Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I will just add a few points to Bob's testimony. First, we agree with DLCD's testimony as it relates to what provisions there are in state law to address this, and would really also get behind and help in the community to utilize the tools in place. We're concerned that any land use that, in a sense, and the term that my friends in the farming community use, is supersided on farmland, takes that use out of a planning process that really, in a sense, makes sure that we look at alternatives, make sure that we not only look at the specific situation of the site that's being proposed, but the impacts to the surrounding farms that would may not be part of the land in question, but are implicated by the land use that's ultimately put on that. In this situation, we're talking about some of the most intensive type of agricultural practices found any place in the state of Oregon. They are not compatible with schools. Our pesticides division receives complaints all the time related to spraying in and around schools from all over the state, and that's just in relation to spray. Orchards are noisy, they're dirty, they're dusty, and they're not generally compatible with concentrations of people. I really think the tools are in place here that need to be explored more. Bob talked about urban growth boundary expansions. An urban growth boundary expansion would ensure that a use is more compact and into the city and not protruding out into the orchard land, or is not an island in and amongst agricultural land where you have multiple edges with either existing uses or potential uses. Contrary to what you may have been hearing lately, the agricultural industry in Hood River County is actually healthy. Pear prices are up, tree numbers are up, acres are actually up, And, you know, I can get you the numbers if you'd like on that. But we really see long-term the industry staying in place in Hood River County. I just wanted to correct one statement about the definition of high-value farmland I heard a little earlier. High-value farmland, in terms of a definition, only pertains to lands zoned for exclusive farm use. So if there are other rural lands outside an urban growth boundary, for example, rural service centers, forest lands for that matter, rural residential, other commercial zones, they are not considered high-value farmland and are not subject necessarily to the three-mile limitation on high-value farmland. And with that, I'll quit there and answer any questions.
Any questions?
I can see.
Just two comments, just so they're on the record. You know, my wife and I took over some operations of the orchard 2 years ago from her dad. I, in 7 years of being married in that family, have never seen spray going on a school day. It's always on the weekend. And that's what you end up having to do. I mean, you just work around it. And it's a real challenge. But people think irrigation water is spray. I mean, that's the kind of thing they think, well, it's a Friday and there's a, you know, cherry spray water going off and they think you're spraying and they call the house like, no, that's water. Oh, okay, thanks. So that's the kind of stuff you deal with every day. And B, you're going to have to come help me figure out how to make an 80-acre orchard work with pears, because price might have been up, but the volume apparently is too low and we need more orchard land, and I'd like to apparently buy it along with the school district, so I'll be bidding up for you.
Representative Lopez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your testimony, and I've looked at the bill here, in the second paragraph about halfway down, and I'll quote, it says, this bill will allow any public school, regardless of whether it would serve a rural or urban population, to locate it within 3 miles outside the urban growth boundary in Hood River County without restrictions. Can you redefine or restate your position here? I mean, we're talking about Hood River County, and I think in your testimony you said this would allow it to happen anywhere in the state. So can you clarify your position, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, I apologize if I was misunderstood. What I indicated is that we're not in support of a bill for a particular county or city as this is, but that we are of the understanding that there is another piece of legislation that's on its way that is going to be very similar and is going to apply statewide. Maybe that won't materialize. That would be good. But what I'm just getting at is that it's not going to stop here. I think if we do pass a bill for one community, all other communities are going to ask for the same benefit.
Representative Boquist.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of several questions follow up. Can you give an explanation? I mean, this, and obviously we're sitting looking at a bill 2465. We've got the former Planning Commission director from Hood River County here. I recall 2 years ago sitting in Elaine Shetterly's office with a handful of new representatives who said, we're here to say yes and figure out how to do this. And, well, I appreciate the offer that you should sit down and work with Hood River now. Why haven't you worked with them to date?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, our staff has spent a considerable amount of time working with Hood River in the last couple of years, and almost all of that effort has been with regard to industrial sites and with regard to some extent with affordable housing, and that has been at the city's request. We have not received a request to try and help that city find school sites or to help that city expand their boundary to make sure there are adequate school sites. That's what I have been told by my staff. So that's why I testified today that we would look forward to that opportunity to work with the city on those issues, but up to now it hadn't been a request that we received.
Mr. Chair, it is more of a statement. Two things to kind of correct. And I've not read at length the School Board Association material that's been put out here, but the gist of it is you know, community-centered schools. Those of us that represent rural areas, live in rural areas, you know, don't like to live in little cardboard boxes inside the city. And the whole concept of a community-centered school is not making it inside a city. So it's the case of where we're talking about having rural schools. I think it's perfectly acceptable. And there is land use planning rules out there that allow us to build schools in certain areas in the rural area. So I kind of take offense at the notion that we have to build all of our schools inside the urban growth boundaries. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? as we get, I think there's at least one more person to testify, but I am going to encourage at Representative Smith and Senator Metzger to work with you and to work with the school district and come up with something because, and I'll talk a little more about that as we end, but I appreciate the offer and look forward to that. And currently the last one signed up who's here is Stephen Kafori. Was Daniel back?
Yeah.
Well, he's back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori.
One second. Dan, do you want to just leave your written testimony? Is that enough? Or do you want to come up here and say something?
If it doesn't add anything to what else has been said,
okay.
I'll happily relinquish
okay.
the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before I begin my testimony on the bill, I'd like to just correct one thing that Brad Chalifax said to you earlier. He was talking about what's happening over in Eastern Oregon. He said there is no land trust in Eastern Oregon, so the people in La Grande who were concerned about what was going to happen in Mount Emily were out of luck. Luckily, there is a land trust. One of my clients, the Trust for Public Land, is working with the citizens of La Grande on the Mount Emily situation, and we hope that we can do something good over there. So whatever you do with those other bills that helps the situation, we're working on it, too.
Okay.
I'd like to just very quickly address the bill, Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. Without being redundant, I just want to say that we oppose the bill. We would look forward to working with the people. We understand there's a problem, and we think that land use planning can resolve problems as well as put up blocks of things. I wanted to bring some information to those people who were not here two sessions ago when a similar problem arose in Hood River, and a company that built windows wanted to establish a land factory on some land just outside the urban growth boundary, and a bill was brought here to cite that plant legislatively. And it was the suggestion was made, why don't we try an exception to the land use planning process, as Representative McPherson suggested. The concern was it would take too long. Mr. Chairman, the exception came through before the bill passed. So I think that it is not, some people think that you know, land use processes are long time, slow, difficult things to work through. They can work. The land use planning system can work, and we would like to make it work in this process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? No. I guess what I will say before we end this one is that we obviously have a lot of work to do here to come up with a solution that can work. But being an old high school principal, it is really important for communities to have schools. And we have to come up with some kind of solution to this. And I hope that we can get this group together to work before we have to hear again to figure out what we're going to do with this session. And I am... You may be the poster child for trying to help us figure some of these things out and do it in the right way, and I hope that we can get that to happen. The last thing I would say in looking at things is that, you know, we have in our rural areas gotten used to having these larger areas for schools, and we may need to go back and look at some of the stuff that's happened in urban wares and move up and see if there's ways we can build some schools and have, you know, multiple schools in a larger building than when the property we already have. And I, you know, we have faced that issue in our local district a few times because of the cost of property. And I guess I would just encourage you to, as you're looking at that, look at some of those things too, because it's pretty remarkable in some schools I visited where they have multiple schools in the same building, but they've built up rather than out. And I hope that we can start looking and talking about some of those things as well. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. So we will close our hearing on House Bill 2465. Thank you all for being here.
And how are we going to legacy floor?
We're going to be open a hearing on House Bill 2468. And obviously we will not have time today to take all that testimony. I have another committee meeting, as do half of this committee, shortly, just down the hall. And so and it's already full. They're waiting for us. And so that's right. We will take as much testimony as we can today, and then we will be putting this one forward to a week from today. Tuesday is what it looks like. So we'll continue the hearing. We'll have another hearing starting that day. But to begin our hearing today, we have with us two colleagues that I would like to call up to the podium, Representative Hovey and Representative Burley.
I'll take the left.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am grateful for having the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2468, which is an enhancement to legislation passed in the 2005 Oregon Legislature allowing Oregon to participate in the Forest Legacy Program of the U.S. Department of Agriculture for Forest Service. This program provides federal monies to assist in the protection of forest lands for the purpose of timber production, recreation, conservation, and other forest uses. The Forest Legacy Program was established in 1990 and has been providing millions of dollars to participating states every year since. This year's allocation will be approximately $61,500,000. The conservation of forest land, or the conversion of forest land to non-forest uses, is a great threat to Oregon's economy and environment. And these pressures have increased greatly in a post-Measure 37 Oregon. This program is designed to be flexible in meeting the desires of our state and local communities in the use of our forests. Unfortunately, in passing the authorizing legislation last session, a restriction requiring that the Forest Legacy Program is limited to properties wholly within urban growth boundaries. This restriction excludes almost all forest properties that would normally be considered in this program. It also could diminish the amount of buildable land inside urban growth boundaries. House Bill 2468 simply removes this restriction and allows Oregon to fully participate in every aspect of the Forest Legacy Program. This program provides opportunities for protecting forests for industry, recreation, environmental, and other forest uses. House Bill 2468 represents something all Oregonians can appreciate. I hope this committee, the legislature, and the governor pass this legislation aimed at protecting Oregon's future forests. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. State Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, the City of Bend, also a certified forester, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify on House Bill. I don't know this because I'm a chief co-sponsor of this, 2468. And I want to commend my colleague here. He had very nice typed up notes for the record. I unfortunately don't. A few statistics just to start out, Mr. Chair. Forest land nationally per capita has declined by half from roughly 5 acres to less than 2.7 acres per person. This rate of decline in the Pacific Northwest is actually more than that. It's about two-thirds. About 1 million acres of private forest land were lost to development each year from 1992 to 97. That's the most recent statistics I have. And projections are that there could be another 26 million acres. Again, these are all national figures that could be lost to development by 2030. Now, more locally, my concern is about trying to maintain the working force that we've got left in eastern Oregon, and this is particularly because of some issues. You know, when I moved over to the east side in 1993 to Bend, there was a sawmill still in the city of Bend. There were several in Prineville. Of course, the Gilcrest Mill was running. There were quite a few down in Kay Falls and some other areas. But today, the only one we've got left, as we heard earlier, is the one in central Oregon, is in Gilcrest. In the Blue Mountain region, there were 15 years ago, there were 24 sawmills running. Today, there's 10 left. And what makes this particularly troublesome to me is that in eastern Oregon, the federal government owns about 60% of the commercial forest land. Yet they only provide about 10% of the needs of even what's remaining today as far as the forest industry is concerned. So this puts even more pressure on the private forest lands to be able to provide some materials to keep what we have left of an industry infrastructure in eastern Oregon. There's two really major industrial forest landowners, or I should say there were, in eastern Oregon. We heard about one of them, Crown Pacific, and their bankruptcy several years ago. And the other one was what used to be Boise Cascade. They reorganized, I think, maybe 3 years ago. The organization that now owns their timberlands, we've already seen some of those in northern Idaho be sold off for development purposes. I think one tract for a ski resort. Mr. Chalfant talked about the Mount Emily property outside of LeGrand, which is currently on the market. So my concern is trying to keep these working forests working. Now, I absolutely respect private property. I'd rather see this stay in private ownership. But I'm also very concerned about this conversion of forest land to other uses, and that's one of the reasons why I support this bill. If I could, just real quickly, the Forest Legacy Program was created by the Cooperative Forestry Assistance Act of 1978, and it was amended by both the 1990 and 1996 Farm Bills. It is a voluntary private land conservation program, and I emphasize that because it's a willing seller, willing buyer program, and I think that's really important. It's a conservation program between the USDA Forest Service, states, land trusts, and private landowners, providing federal financial assistance leveraged by non-federal cost sharing to protect forest land. So with Forest Legacy, I believe we have another tool in the toolbox to help keep these working forests in a working condition. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes.
Representative. Because I don't know the history of this, why was it within a UGB? And if you don't know, that's all.
Oh, we know.
For the record, Representative Paul Holby from District 8, I think I failed to do that at the beginning. And, you know, Representative, I've asked myself that same question. That's all I'm willing to say. I just want to commend Representative Burley. We worked on this, on a couple of forest issues together last session, and, you know, a lot of different interests, you know, are looking at these subject matter about these forests, you know, and the fact is we're losing them, whether or not we're losing them out of forest and timber production, which is really a huge issue for our state. But this program also provides the ability to preserve forests for other purposes, which sometimes becomes a bone of contention, perhaps, which is for environmental conservation units, perhaps, or, you know. So this program is very flexible, but most of the money and most of the dollars that have been spent in this program have gone towards preserving working timberlands for production, as opposed to environmental reasons. But the program is very flexible and is driven by the community at large as to what they want to do with the program if they make good pitches to the Department of Forestry and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Our state has identified some natural areas that need to be preserved, or, you know, has value to the public in being preserved anyway. And it also identifies a lot of forest lands that need to be preserved in timber production. And quite frankly, there's a lot of pressures in this state, especially today, to do away with forest uses. And I think that's something we really need to take note of and act on. So I just really appreciate the opportunity and hope this committee sees the benefit to everybody in Oregon for this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think the subsequent witnesses will, I think, outline a little bit more in detail how this program works. One of the things in particular I'd encourage you to listen about is the assessment of need. That under this program, the Department of Forestry is authorized to participate with the U.S. Forest Service in the Forest Legacy Program, and one of the things that the department would have to do is develop this assessment of need, which kind of identifies the potential projects and prioritizes them to some extent. And that's where you really get at the key of trying to figure out what do we as a state, you know, what do we want this authority to help us do. Provide little parks, which this was some of the contentious stuff we were dealing with last session, or do you want to try and protect large blocks of working forest land? It's really how the bill is drafted, how the authority is shaped, and how this assessment of need is constructed that helps you set those priorities and what you're really trying to do with these federal dollars.
Representative Dinkfelder,
I just want to thank my colleagues for bringing this forward, because it's been a frustration for the last three sessions, and unfortunately, to I think the Department of Forestry can probably respond to Representative Maurer's question, but I think we've passed up some good opportunities in the state. I mean, this is a program that in the past, except for a small pass-through responsibility that the Department of Forestry has, it has been federal money matched with local funds, and we've turned that down. We turned away a lot of federal money because we didn't have the ability or the will to pass it through our State Department of Forestry. But I just wanted to thank you for bringing this forward.
And
Department of Forestry can probably speak a little bit more on the history. He's shaking his head. So to answer your question, though, the UGB, that was an allowance last session because there was no federal, no forest legacy money coming through the state. So last session we fought to get federal to get the legacy dollars through within the UGB, and now we're saying in other parts of the state.
There, and I'll give one more little part of it to just so okay. Answer that question as well. That was a negotiated settlement as we went through this whole thing last session that everybody could agree to, and it went through and it passed, and we got legacy money. Part of the biggest issue that separates on this one has to do with private ownership, and it was partly addressed by the testimony. When these trusts happen, other things happen, often at times they become taken out of the public, they become public properties, and you lose tax base and other kinds of issues. And as you heard today's testimony, there are ways of not doing that as well. And so those discussions have been going on for a long time. And
but I just want to emphasize, Mr. Chair, if I may, that the program has been and always will be willing landowners, fair market value. I mean, there's no, requirement somebody has to sell their land. It's always been with willing landowners that are interested in participating in the program.
Absolutely true. Yes.
One follow-up. This is probably yes no. So this change in language is a fundamental shift in this program. An expansion of this program.
Right. Yes.
Thank you.
That's absolutely true.
Well,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. This language is maybe a fundamental shift in policy for the state of Oregon, but quite frankly, the urban growth boundary restriction was a fundamental shift in the policy of the federal legacy program itself. The federal legacy program itself is designed to accommodate all those different uses and shouldn't really be limited, in my mind, to restrictions put on it by the state, because then we're sort of tying our hands behind our back a little bit and not really having the ability to take full advantage of the program. And in fact, of the proposed budget, that's the 2007 budget, there's a section of land in my district, very small, that is proposed for $460,000, I believe, to be included. That's going to be bought and put into a city park skyline trail where they're trying to protect the old Willamette Valley oak savanna around the south end of Eugene, which really has not much timber value, but has a great deal of aesthetic value and environmental value to many folks in my district. So this program does allow that sort of use, and I would think that the state's assessment of need would always include those sorts of uses, as well as the issues that Representative Burley has spoken to is really protecting some of our forest lands as we're seeing those being subdivided.
I know, Mr. Chair, you want to move on, but just very, very briefly, I think that I would submit, and subsequent witnesses may correct me, but really the national program was really intended to look at these large blocks and these large conversions of that major land use type. And some statistics I also trust subsequent witnesses will provide show in other states where these transactions, they're hundreds of thousands of acres in size. They're really quite significant transactions using the Forest Legacy Program. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
One question, Representative Burley, as a forester. We heard in the previous testimony about the schools about the rising cost of property, and there comes a point when it's hard to be ag when the property is worth so much. What's the break-even point in forestry right now for acres of forest land with regard to the forest cost, and then you can actually make money on it? Do you have an idea about those numbers?
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, that's going to vary by region.
Oh, okay. We'll go with this kind of forest in Bend, the pine forest.
Well, that's, you know, with when Mr. Chalfon was testifying about the former Bull Springs tree farm, 33,000 acres, that property right now could not, on a sustainable basis, generate enough revenue to pay for the value of the property because of the higher and better value associated with it. But, you know, actual dollar figures, it's just that's going to vary significantly.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We have another committee to go to fairly quickly, and I looked at the list, and there's only one name here that I was concerned about who came awise, and that was Sarah, is it Medley, from Eugene. And so I don't know if I want to have them have to come back. So if you want to come up, that would be great. And then
thank you very much.
Yeah.
I asked Amanda Rich to come up. She's also here. We kind of co-testifying. Good afternoon, Chair and rest of the committee. My name is Sarah Maderi, and I'm the Natural Resources Manager for the City of Eugene. And I felt like I really wanted to come up here and give some testimony in this hearing, as right now the City of Eugene has the only application in for Forest Legacy dollars in the state. And so I just want to talk to you a little bit about the importance of that. Thank you for the work that you all did in the 2005 session to make that a possibility. And we were able to find a 25-acre site fully within the UGB. It was hard to do, but I want to say it's an extremely significant piece of property. It's not the way, and I'm glad I can talk a little bit about the state's assessment of need, but the state looked at forests all over Oregon and decided, you know, these are the ones that are the highest value for us to protect. And sometimes that was for timber interests, and in other times it was because it had some sort of extremely unique, highly threatened ecologic value. And the southwestern foothills of Eugene has some of the best remaining mix of oaks and oak woodlands left in the state, and especially in the Willamette Valley. So this 25 acres is right there in a very threatened piece of property. It was owned by a developer, and he came to us and said, we want to protect this oak woodland. So that 25 acres, as though it is very insignificant on the national scale, we're number 30 out of 31, and we're asking for $460,000 when I think the top number is somewhere in the millions, $2 million for a piece of property in Maine. Or, you know, I just want to say that I think Oregon is really known for its forests. And ever since I've been involved in this program, I've just been amazed that Oregon isn't fully participating in the Forest Legacy Program. And when people think of Oregon, that's what they think of. And it's not just because of our deep connection to the economy. It's the social benefits, the ecological benefits, and it's just part of who we are. The Forest Legacy Program, in my mind, is a really good program. And it's one of those ones that finds that really difficult balance between working with landowners and working landowners, and also finding those recreational and ecological values. And I think this is a really good way for people to hang on to their property, still be able to farm it, and yet protect it from something that would forever take it out of the ability to serve as an important connection. I'll try to be really quick here, and then you can go. Lastly, I wanted to just tell you that when Forest Legacy grant applications are reviewed, they're really reviewed and ranked nationally on four items. And those four items are, first, they look at the importance. They look at how the state has valued it in its own assessment of need. Has it been identified by the state as an important forest? They look at how ready it is. Is this something you're really going to be able to move on, or is we going to have this money hanging out there for years? How threatened is it? What's going on in the area? And Measure 37 would certainly factor into that threatened category. But more importantly, it looks at how strategic it is. And they're looking at how you're making connections, bigger connections. Are you connected to other forest lands? It's not a program that anybody can just kind of go in and say, hey, I want to
throw my property into this and get money. It really has to be part of a bigger forest plan, and so I think that's an important thing when people are thinking about how the UGB can fit into that, because a UGB really doesn't recognize those connections in forests, and so it makes it really difficult to find a good strategic connection when you have that political boundary just set in there. So I really urge you to support this bill. I think it's good for Oregon, and a lot of good projects should come out of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Recreation and Park Association, and I also represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and both of those organizations are wholeheartedly in support of this bill. I'm in the building on a regular basis, and so I'd be happy to come back next Tuesday and talk to you further if you have if you're interested in that. I did place our testimony on the record, and then also one of our ORPA members, Metro, also placed their testimony into the record. I won't take up any more of your time right now, but be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Okay, thanks. Any questions or
comment, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
You said you were surprised that we were not in the Forest Legacy Program, and when you're swimming in the ocean, the last thing you need is salt water. And so I think it's a realization today that these things are important.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And I want to thank all the other people and hope to see you on Tuesday when we redo this. But right now we will close our public hearing on 2468. Thank you very much. We'll also close our meeting on Ag and Natural Resources. Thank you very much for reminding me.
So, did we do the work session? On-